Good morning. This is Good Medicine, Cheaper Medicine. I'm Nash Gabriel. With me is, of course, Shelley Wrench. And today, Shelley, we have a very special program with our good friend, right?
Yes.
Greg has a story, and we want to share the story with the audience. When? How many years ago was it, Greg?
19
years ago. Mm-hmm. Tell us what happened.
I got sick. I thought I was immortal, but I found out I wasn't. And when I went to my doctor, ran some tests, and found out I had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, stage 4, terminal, incurable. I had no insurance, which was a problem. I went to my doctor. He said, let me make an appointment for you to see an oncologist. And they said,
I guess there was no Obamacare in those days, right?
No. But he said, let me make an appointment for you. And so I was standing at the desk waiting to make an appointment. And the secretary says, they just need your insurance information. And I said, well, I don't have insurance. And then she just paused for a minute and told the person on the other line, well, we'll have to call you back. And then I was referred to the city intern clinic, since I had no money, and I felt
they said you had cancer.
Yes, stage 4.
Have they done biopsy yet?
Yes, they had.
They said it was non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, right?
Yes, stage 4, yes.
They sent you to a clinic, to an internist? Can't be right.
Well, they were going to set up to go to an oncologist,
right?
And then because I didn't have insurance, they sent me to an internist over at City Hospital.
That's just absolutely horrible.
And from there, I felt like I just got shipped to a veterinary hospital. No, it was terrible. So I didn't know what to do.
Not a VA hospital, a vet hospital, meaning for dogs and
yeah, for dogs and cats, right?
just to clarify.
Yeah. So I was.
Yeah, remember one thing: we and dogs and cats really we share a lot of genes. So
uh-huh.
Actually, we should have the same hospital. I think.
Sometimes I think you might get better care.
We're closer to the monkey.
Sometimes
a lot of veterinarians are very, very loving, caring people. Anyway,
that's right,
guys. This is Greg Walker, and again, he has a story. Actually, it's a very multifaceted story about the first thing you mentioned is the fact that you had no insurance,
right.
That they shifted you. I hope this thing doesn't happen very often because I have stuck my neck more than once in the papers I have written letters to the editor and saying not a single cancer patient goes untreated because he has no insurance. Mm-hmm. And they have challenged. I want anybody who had cancer and had no insurance and who was denied treatment. And I said, please, that's a challenge. Call me because you know what? We don't think those things happen, but you're proving me wrong.
In this case, he still got care, but it's second-rate care.
Well, it's not second-rate. There was no specialist involved.
Right.
So you went to the internist. What did he say?
He just confirmed that I was in a world of trouble, and they referred me to...
Was that a scientific term for your disease, world of trouble?
Yeah,
or he was more...
Yeah. That there was no hope, that I could live several years if everything went my way.
That's the internist.
Yes. Of course, he said he would send me to an oncologist where I could go through traditional treatment for that. And I was getting ready to do that, and then I began to explore other options, like going to Germany. Of course, I went there. And
So you didn't see any oncologist here in the beginning?
I started to, but...
What did he or she say?
Well, they said there was no hope for me, but that could extend my life some.
The oncologist said that?
Yes.
Are you sure?
Yeah, pretty much. Really, in fact, sure? I went to see two of them, and they said, the first one said that I could, if I could, I would probably be strong enough to weather through the first part of the treatment, but it would eventually, take my life. And so I went to get a second opinion, and I went up to the Ireland Cancer Center. I don't know if I'm supposed to say that, but
yes, I did.
I went up there. And the doctor that I was referred to, I talked to the doctor, and this doctor said, told me what I needed to do. I said, well, thank you for the information. I'll consider it, and I'll make my decision.
But what did he also give you the same gloom day prognosis?
Well, not exactly at first, but when I said I was going to consider the option and what this doctor was saying to me, the doctor responded by saying, don't you know that you could die? You need to do what I... And I was like, well, you just made my decision for me.
Oh, my goodness.
And I left there.
Yeah, but he said that if you don't get this treated, you might die, right?
If I don't do what they were saying.
Well, he was right, though.
Well, ultimately,
except the way he said it wasn't nice to you, right?
Yeah, and so,
But it was scientific.
But what I said to him, I said, you know, you sound just like the doctor that I went to the first time. And I said,
wasn't me, was it?
No. Okay. No, I'm glad. I mean, thank sure. God I came.
Just making sure. Okay.
But I said to the doctor, I said, you remind me of the doctor that was the first opinion I got. And the doctor said, yeah, that's the person I trained under.
And that made sense to you.
I said, are you kidding?
Oh, yeah, God.
You really sound a lot like him. So anyway, then I was left
That's
with,
good that we actually train people who end up being like us. That's awesome.
It can be good, yeah.
So it can be good. So what did you do?
Well, I started looking on the online, on the internet. Can I share something just real quick that really kind of summarizes? I mentioned it to Shelley earlier. This morning I got up and I read the Bible, and so I'm thinking about what we're going to talk about today. And I was just led to this portion in Mark chapter 5, and it says, Jesus was on his way to go visit this guy whose daughter was very sick. And this woman starts coming through the crowd that had been sick for 12 years with a terminal blood disease. And it says, and it makes this statement, doctor, it says, she had suffered much under the care of many physicians and had spent her whole living, and rather than growing better, she grew only worse. And this whole crowd was keeping her from getting to Jesus. And I start thinking, that's the way it is when people get sick. They're looking at this horrendous thing and this crowd of voices and obstacles. And how do they get the answer that they need? How do they get to the answer that they need? And that's what my life was like. Here I have no insurance. I don't know what to do. Everything looks grim. I'm going to die. I have a 10-year-old son. I just want to live and see him grow up. And I have no options that look promising. And so I went online and I discovered a clinic in Germany where they did other types of treatment.
And just to go back to the Bible verse.
Yes.
You're saying that the verse actually is saying predicting or is giving you an analogy.
Yes.
To when you are through the crisis of having a serious disease, and there are the various voices around you, right. in this day and age, it is when you go to the internet, you get 50 opinions. None of them agree with each other, right?
Right.
You just need to find where Jesus is among all those opinions to listen to, right?
Right. Yes.
Keep going. Interesting. Very interesting.
So I'm feeling hopeless, and I discovered this clinic in, well, Dr. Robert Atkins, who many people know as the diet doctor. I was privileged to be able to go see him, and he said, that's right, there's no hope for you.
You thought the diet will cure you?
Well, he actually did a lot of
research. Now I know why the guys at the Ireland Cancer Center were pissed off with you. You actually went to the diet doctor, okay, to treat your lymphoma, huh?
But actually, he had a lot of interest in cancer treatment and things like that. And he said there was no hope for me in America, that I needed to go to Germany where there were treatments that weren't being used in America, such as...
He said there is no hope for you in America.
That's right, no hope for
you. But too bad he's dead, otherwise I'll give him a call now.
Well, he said he could change my... he could make me healthier to face the disease.
You know what? If he was alive, I'll call him and tell him, Dr. Atkins, stick with your damn diet, you know? Okay, so keep going.
So anyway,
He told
me about a clinic outside of Munich in Bad Aibling, Germany, where they were doing hyperthermia, where they were heating the body up and infusing you with chemotherapy, things like that, and they were having good results. And he said that he thought that was
so. What do they do? They hook you with chemo. And you put you in an oven.
Well, first I had to raise the money to go there, and I had like 25 cents. So everybody in Akron that knows me had spaghetti dinners and raised like $30,000, and I went there. And I got on a plane, and I get over there, and they get me in the clinic. And the first thing I noticed there in Germany was that the German people were refused treatment, while the Americans with the dollar bills were the ones they were seeing.
Well, it's probably because Americans came with more dollars than what the Germans had.
That's right. And so they promised me that, on the phone, they promised me they could put me in remission. They promised me that. So I get there, and I go into these treatments where they insert like a big rod into me.
What do you mean?
Rectally. They put this rod inside me. And they heated up my body core temperature.
Oh, so they put you in an oven.
Yeah,
no?
Right. Basically cooked me from the inside out like 106 degrees. So the rod, insulated my brain stem so it wouldn't fry my brain. And then...
How big was that rod? Hold on a second. This is... I've never... You haven't heard of this before. How big was that rod?
It was about I don't know, 3 feet.
So it was like like colonoscope.
Yes, yes.
Hopefully there was some sedation.
I was morphine, you know, so I was smiling while they did it, you know, but I was
okay.
Much like how you're supposed to
How long did they keep that thing inside you?
I don't know. The treatment went on for several hours, I think.
With the rod inside?
Yes.
Oh,
and then they would infuse heavy glucose into my system, which they said was causing the cancer to be very aggressive. And then while it was in aggressive mode, they would bomb me with CHOP therapy, which is chemotherapy.
Can I ask you a question?
Uh-huh.
When they were doing all this, deep inside, did you have any doubts that this thing could be just a hoax?
No, because I was desperate.
And it costs a lot of money, so did how could ever, it be a hoax?
And it costs a lot of money, and I felt it had to have validity because of
everything about it. Did you ever think at that time, why don't American cancer doctors do the same? Did that thought come to your mind?
Well, they told me that it wasn't cleared for use in the United States, which is why American doctors weren't here.
They
were studying it in Texas or something.
So in the United States, we're not allowed to heat a rod and stick it in people's rear end.
Right, yeah.
And give them chemo with it. You're right. We are not allowed to do that.
I don't think we could get away with that.
So then how many treatments you had?
I was there a month, and I had about one a week. So I had four, and then I recovered from the treatment the rest of the time. And Germany was a nice place. I enjoyed traveling around Germany because they had a principle of not just laying around in a bed and being sick. So I got a car and I traveled around Germany. I did that stuff in between.
So they gave you every week you got the heating thing, right?
Yes.
And then you get the chemo every 3 weeks?
No, the chemo was right along with the heat treatment every week.
So it was a CHOP therapy right along with it.
Right along. They infused it at the same time.
Yeah, but we don't give CHOP every week. We give it every 3 weeks.
Well, it would have been, but they
fragmented it.
Mm-hmm.
Then after 4 weeks, what happened?
Then they came in my room after 4 weeks, and the doctor, I won't say his name because he's probably well known, but he came in the room and he said, well, we've done what we can, and the disease has reversed some. You're in better shape than when you came here, but you need monoclonal antibodies, and those are too expensive for it to be done here. You'll have to go back to America.
Oh, that was when Rituxan was just discovered.
Yes.
1996, was it?
98, 97.
Yeah, it was 99 when I was doing it.
Yeah, 98.
So, yeah.
When you saw the oncologist in the U.S. before you go to Germany, mm-hmm. did they mention Rituxan?
No.
Probably because it was a standard thing. They just
it might have been something to do eventually, but they were going after stage four. They were going.
Is it possible that they told you go back for monoclonal antibody because you ran out of money or you still had some money to pay?
Well, they knew I was out of money, but they probably told me. He said it was just cost prohibitive for me to do it there, that I would have to go to the United States.
How compassionate! Yet he charged you thousands of dollars to stick a hot rod in your rear end. Mm-hmm. It's very, very compact.
And then, right. So I was $30,000. I wasn't cured. I saw a lot of cool things in Germany, but I was still sick. And then I came back here even more hopeless.
So you came back. What happened?
My sister, God bless her, had found out about your clinic and had made arrangements for me to come in and see you. And I was negotiating for Medicare and Medicaid at the time, although I didn't have it. And disability because at the time we thought it would be terminal.
Right.
So I came in originally, sat down with you, and I treated you kind of like the other doctors because I didn't know what you were like. And so when you told me what it would take.
So you were nasty with me, although you came seeking my compassionate opinion?
Yes, right. Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. Got a lot of people like you, by the way.
Okay. So you stepped out of the room for a moment,
okay.
And you came back in and you said, I don't often say this, but I'll say this to you. What is it that you want me to do for you? And I said, I have a 10-year-old son, and I want to see him grow up. And you said, then I recommend that you listen to what I tell you to do. And we set up a program for me to start into treatment at your clinic.
Basically, I told you, I'm not interested in your opinion. I am more proud of my opinion than my abilities.
Yeah, yeah. You were in a better position to say that to me. I didn't know anything about medicine. I just thought I did.
So there was something you mentioned once about in between the pages.
Yeah, that's right. Now, that's miraculous. When I was online looking for solutions, I remember every place I went, it just sounded like a textbook. Doctors just sounded like textbooks, and the textbook didn't give me much hope.
You mean copycat? We just copy each other?
Yeah, they're just saying the same
stuff. We just have a regimen we printed, distributed, that's available online. We call that guidelines.
Oh, okay, guidelines.
And there's a better word for that, standard of care. Mm-hmm. In fact, lawyers love that term because mm-hmm. if you deviate from that and something wrong happens, not necessarily because of that,
right?
The malpractice lawyers, and there are a bunch of them in town, of course, they love that because mm-hmm. to them in court, that's an admission that you didn't follow the guidelines. You right. didn't do mm-hmm. what other doctors do. And actually, mm-hmm. if you, in my opinion, if you do every time what other doctors do, you actually are a lousy doctor.
Right.
In my opinion. Mm-hmm. So tell us about the between the pages.
So I was actually just, I was discouraged and I just in my heart, I just cried. I said, God, isn't there anyone that can do something in between the pages? And so when I came under your care in 1999 and you began to treat me, we came to a certain point in my treatment. You called me and you said, well, this particular therapy has done about what it can do for you. And I would like to try something in between the pages. Mm-hmm. And when you said that inside my heart, I couldn't believe you said that because that was my prayer. And I said, of course. And so we began on another regiment. And I shortly thereafter did go into
so for the audience, for the listeners, I can tell you what that meant. the standard treatment for your disease, which was kind of aggressive lymphoma,
right?
Although under the microscope it didn't look as aggressive, mm-hmm. but behavior wise it was.
Yeah.
The standard thing is you give R-CHOP. That's a no-no in my book. I don't always give R-CHOP because 20-30% of the time after 10 years. Those patients do get heart failure.
Right.
So I use another regimen was designed by the National Cancer Institute called Promacitabom. And to me, that regimen is at least as good, less side effects. So I gave you that. But I was at that time having my theories about why we only can cure 40% of lymphoma. What is it? And one of the things I discovered was when patients with lymphoma come back, we don't treat them with the same drug. We treat them with a different regimen called mm-hmm. DHAP, ESHAP, whatever. There are so many of them very similar to each other.
Right.
And that time I had already treated several patients where everybody says, according to the book, they are not curable.
Mm-hmm.
And that gave me always a challenge. Somebody says they're curable, I say, dare me say that.
Mm-hmm.
I will try. And so what I do immediately when we reach that stage, when I told you what we gave you had achieved the best it can. And my theory was, if the other regimens work when the cancer comes back, wouldn't it work even now better?
Mm-hmm.
So I'll give them that. There's a theory behind that. The theory is called sequential non-cross-resistant chemotherapy. Long name. Designed by two oncologists from New York. Both of them actually were mathematicians and oncologists. And they drew some mathematical formula. And they concluded that if we do this, we cure more people. Bingo.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not the only one. Actually, we have about 20, 30 patients who were basically written off. They were told that, yes, we can put in remission, but he will die from this. Mm-hmm. And most of them, I don't see them anymore because I just learned after 10 years, bye-bye.
Yeah.
You have other issues. We still continue to see you.
Right.
Yeah, it used to be the Thursday crowd. Remember, we would have all the people in the same kind of boat, the Thursday crowd.
Yeah, yeah.
In the infusion room, yes.
What was
phenomenal.
It?
Phenomenal.
I just wonder, how do you feel now, of course?
Great. I feel good. Yeah.
You, when I see you in the office, you always say that it was basically the prayers that cured you, right?
Well, okay, let me mention this. Okay, when I was sick.
That's okay.
Okay,
I'm used to this.
Okay.
All the hard work.
Yeah.
And then got
you're going to like this. You're going to like this. In my faith, there are different belief systems within the Christian faith. Some say you should go to a doctor. Some say you should not. You should not. They say you shouldn't because if you really had faith, God would just heal you. Well, when I was wrenching over the issue in my own heart, whether I should actually go for treatment, I came across the verse where Paul was all alone in prison at the end of his life, and he talked about everyone who had betrayed him, and he said, Luke, the beloved physician, is the only one who's with me. And it seemed like God was telling me that physicians aren't evil. Like some of my faith.
Wow, who gave you that brilliant idea?
Well, just like I said, there's various viewpoints within Christianity. I don't hold to that myself. But so I came and I've been with you almost 20 years. And I would say that God has used you to be a beloved physician in my life, the same way as he did Luke, to keep Luke alive in his life. And so, and I was to other doctors just like that woman, and there was no hope for me, and I'm alive 20 years later. So I have nothing but wonderful things to say. And I always say, yes, God healed me. It was God who brought me through. But it doesn't hurt to have an angel named Gabriel on your side either.
Ooh,
the angel Gabriel.
You're going very deep. You know what? I honestly, I think that's very, very way, very good way of putting it. Is that God worked through us in healing people. Remember the story? The guy who was fishing and his boat capsized. And remember that story when finally, you know, helicopter came, rescuers, and finally was drowning, and then he went to God when after he died, and he said, God, why didn't you send somebody to, why didn't you save me? He said, you an idiot. I sent you the Coast Guard, and I said, all these people came were in my name, and you were just stupid not to listen, and you thought that God will personally show up. I like that analogy.
That's right, and so I believe that's wisdom. That's God has, see, number one, you're a doctor. That's not a profession. That's a calling. I believe that God called you to be who you are and what you are in your approach. And so, and I see him using you to keep me alive. So I praise that, and I'm thankful for that.
That's a very complimentary statement that our profession is a calling. I truly, truly believe in that. I don't know whether the way... Shelley, what do you think of that? How is that evolving?
Well, I was just thinking about you were supposed to be a priest.
Yes.
So, I mean, maybe you decided to still do both. I mean, use your mind and your skills and your clinical decision making, mm-hmm. but combine it with what you should have been.
I really was very much serious about becoming a priest. I mean, the bishop in our town in Iraq was very hopeful. He always called me Lamb of God, whatever. And until you finish grade school, sixth grade, then you go, the priesthood in Iraq was, you go to the seminary from the seventh grade until you finish college. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of thinking about it, and then I asked my mom, I said, so mom, when do I get married? She said, never. That idea of celibacy didn't sit very well with me. So thank God.
Me either.
Yeah, I didn't think it was a smart thing. And dad always, my father was not really as religious as my mother was. And he always said, no, I think you're smart. You have good genes. I would like to see those genes propagate in the society, because if you become a priest, supposedly it's done, right? Supposedly.
Mm-hmm. That's always the question.
So anyway, it is a calling. But Shelley, my question to you was, is our profession, I'm not trying to be critical of the profession, but there is no doubt that Luke, one of the disciples, was a different physician from what we are now. Abyssinia was a different physician. Actually, when I was driving, coming down to the station just this afternoon, I was wondering how much the medical profession has changed in terms of what people like Greg view us, what the society think of us. He's saying that we had a calling, and that immediately put us in the level of clergy even better. Has that changed?
But it has changed, but I think a lot of it has to do with physicians changing as well. It used to be that physicians would go into their clinics with a suit and tie or a white jacket, white coat. They go into the hospital. They look professional. I think doctors, I see them in jeans and shorts doing rounds. I think that they have contributed to some of the changes that we perceive, Greg and I perceive, as physicians. It used to be, you know, more professional than what we're seeing now. When I'm in the hospital and I have a physician coming in to take care of me and he's in jeans and tennis shoes, I don't think of him the same as I used to.
Back to you. Shelley, mm-hmm. this is a very good point. Back to you on the same subject. And that is, you had experience with several docs in the U.S., two of them, oncologists, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. in Germany, right? And by the way, German doctors are superb. I mean, I have practiced medicine in Iraq and Scotland and here. Mm-hmm. Tell you what, I have also encountered many German physicians. They are good. They know what they're doing. Except I didn't know that they do the heating stuff.
They didn't share that with us when we had dinner with them.
Yeah, but we do have some doctors here in the U.S. who do kind of quack stuff like that. Like even Dr. Atkins, when he said, diet might help your cancer, whatever. The question to you is, the physician's attitude with you. I think you brought an example when I almost was with an air of arrogance when I told you, you want my help, you keep quiet and tell you what we need to do. Was that insulting?
I love the hesitation.
Got it.
Okay, I'll say this. Yes, but I was desperate, and I would say insulting, but at the same time, I made an appointment for my first treatment with you, not knowing if I was going to come for it. I made the appointment, but I didn't know if I was going to come. But all I can say is that I believe that God just what determined my decision was, if I could stay alive 5 more minutes to raise my son, I would do whatever it took, it whether it cured me or not, anything that would extend my life. And so I signed up.
I remember going through all that with you and helping you get to that point where we could get coverage and helping.
Yeah. And we didn't even get into that today too much. But you guys, I know I wouldn't have gotten the help and the advice to guide me through those waters of the financial.
I appreciate the compliment, but I want to understand one thing. Mm-hmm. Would your reaction and attitude have been different if I had said to you, you know, Greg, we can do this, we can do this, the standard is this, what do you want to do?
Well, you forced me to make a decision. Your confidence and your aggressiveness caused
me to
make
a decision. I didn't force you to make a decision.
No.
I told you, I didn't give you an ultimatum.
Right.
But I told you this is the way that it should work.
Right.
In my honest, professional, moral, ethical opinion.
Right.
My question is, if I had a different attitude and said, you know, Greg, it's up to you, really. We can do this, we can do that. Because many doctors do that these days.
Right.
Any idea what your reaction would have been?
Oh, gosh. It's hard to say. I just know that your confidence was great.
Is it important for the physician to show confidence in what they know?
Well, yeah. I just say if you know it, you know, I want real confidence, and that's what you exuded was
genuine
confidence.
Instead of those ones, you know, in textbook doing the algorithms and guidelines and pathways, he actually used his.
Yeah, you were impassioned. You were real about what you were doing. That's like. I trusted you.
Greg, it's been great. I'm so glad that you agreed to come and talk about all these not so nice things that happened to you.
Right,
but I think it's important that our listeners know a real live case scenario of what happens in people like you. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Advice to everybody, don't allow that person to stick a hard things in your ear. That's not good. That's not good.
Thank you, Doc.
Thank you, Greg. That was awesome.